Massacre of the Holy Innocents, December 28th. The priest's vestments will be red, the color of martyrs, the martyrdom of these little innocent children. We remember these innocents who gave testimony to Christ, as the opening prayer says, non loquendo sed moriendo, not by speaking, but by dying, just by dying, like that. They were giving testimony to Christ as the first fruits for God of the Lamb. And reading through a series of Old Testament allusions and explicit fulfillment quotations, Matthew shows how these tribulations, right from the beginning, plunge Jesus into the sufferings and the hopes of the people of Israel, and how they are taken up into God's redemptive plan. It even evokes the story of Moses himself, who was saved when all the children in Israel were being killed, thrown into the river. He was saved. He was put into that little basket and hidden away. Plus, Egypt played a role in both Moses' and Jesus' escape from death. Moses, we know, grew up in an Egyptian household, which protected him from Pharaoh's wicked decree. Yet the best of all worlds, he was brought up in an Egyptian household, yet he was educated by his own mother, who had been weaning him. Jesus, too, was taken up by his family to Egypt, and there he avoided Herod's violence. Egypt saved him, yet he was educated by his parents. This correspondence, long known by the fathers, with Moses' childhood, of course, tells us something important about Jesus' future. The infant Jesus, his experiences of divine protection from evil rulers of this world, because like Moses, he is destined to save the people of Israel. Moses led them out of Egypt. And as St. Matthew says, Jesus will save the people from their sins. There's like a parallel there that Matthew sees. Everything can happen to us too. Dark moments can happen in our life. Professional moments of failure. They can all be part of God's mysterious plan. We sometimes demand that everything works out just like what we wanted. That God bless us, we say. God bless us with good plans that work out. But God has a broader vision. Joseph was warned in a dream. He was the protector of the Holy Family. He was the protector that God could count on. Not just because he was strong and resilient and practical and experienced in long journeys. You would say he had street smarts. He knew who to trust. But also because he was faithful and docile and paid heed to those instructions from the angel in his sleep. Thanks to his prompt action, he saved the child against that fury of Herod's soldiers. and against Herod himself, who was just absolutely obsessed with eliminating anyone who might be a challenge to his throne. It's hard to understand how sociopathic Herod became. But then the city of David is filled with the cries of innocent children, the cries of their mothers. It's a dramatic painting of this in the Art Gallery of Ontario by Peter Paul Rubens, dating to the 1620s. It's one of the probably the most valuable painting the Art Gallery of Ontario has ever owned, given to them from a private collector. It's a massive painting. At one point it was partially damaged, but they held it together. We still have the sketches where you see the agony of these mothers still holding their children to their breasts and soldiers smashing down the children. Some years ago, I was asked to give a presentation on The Massacre of the Innocents by Peter Paul Rubens, and as I was describing it on video, I asked them to zoom in on one of the children that is lying there face down in the ground, who's just been killed. It's a very violent painting, and I remembered as seeing that painting, it immediately connected me with a photo of one of the refugee children who was found on a beach some years ago, in a beach, I believe on the Mediterranean, if I recall. His face was down, and a rescuer had just arrived. He had been on a boat with his parents and a number of other refugees. There he lay, and the image was very, very similar. And I asked them, well, why don't you get a zoom in on that picture of Rubens and then the picture of the child? And they said, no, they couldn't do it. There were copyright restrictions. They couldn't do it. But the image was nevertheless very powerful. It is said that Rubens painted that dramatic image. I mean, it's a religious account, of course, but where are you going to put such a violent picture? You're going to put that in a church? Why would he represent such a violent scene? And it was discovered that the picture was commissioned by either an ambassador or a politician of the time in Belgium, who wanted a picture over his fireplace in his living room, so that when other ambassadors came and other politicians and people that they could discuss the horrors of war and diplomacy, how diplomacy could avoid war. Here the city of David is filled with the cries of innocent children and their mothers. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation, says Isaiah. Rachel weeping for her children, she refused to be consoled because they are no more. It's a powerful prophecy of what was going to happen. And Joseph, of course, he had a huge responsibility. He had to think fast. He had to man up. First century Egypt was under Roman rule, but outside of Herod's jurisdiction. It was always a traditional place of refuge for Jews. Indeed, there was a larger population of Jews in Egypt, especially in Alexandria. But nevertheless, the account of such tragedy, innocents being killed like that, is hard to understand. It's hard to place that within the providential plan of God's love. It's very hard. You know, St. Thomas comments on this passage. He says in the following way, he says, how can it be said that they died for Christ since they could not use their freedom? God would not have allowed, he said, that massacre if it had not been of benefit to those children. There's something touching about this, that children die without knowing what is happening. Mothers see their innocent lives cut short without knowing why. There's no apparent explanation. It's just horror. And at first glance, the children's suffering seems unjust, of course, and is unjust, but it seems useless and unjust. But their lives bear witness to a truth. A truth that they aren't fully aware of, or aren't at all aware of. And God rewards their total self-sacrifice with eternal glory, with the enjoyment and direct vision of God, which they are experiencing now. That's why we celebrate them. We don't celebrate the violence, we celebrate that they are experiencing that vision of God that we too hope to enjoy. And the little ones, wrenched from their mother's arms like that, and they were made co-redeemers with Christ at such a young age. Now they enjoy the fruitfulness of their sacrifice. Sacrifice can actually be fruitful. These innocent children were slain for Christ. They follow the spotless Lamb and proclaim forever, glory to you, O Lord. Well, we ask them to intercede for us, these innocent children, adoring God now face to face, so that we too come to have at least an understanding in some way of what sacrifice really means and its value in our life. Let we never just run from sacrifice, be afraid of sacrifice or mortification or self-denial or discomforts because we don't like it. We like comfort, we like pleasure. Maybe we have to ask the Lord to help us understand to what degree we are attached to pleasure in some way, not ready to embrace a sacrifice that can lead us to the glory of God. And not only us, but that can lead others too, since we're all connected. We're all connected in the communion of saints. We have to build this tower. And we began this retreat with the image of the tower. Our Lord said, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? We're building a tower. The daily building of that tower is also in the use of your time, in use of our time. He says this to show that if mere human prudence means that a person should try to work out in advance the risks he may run, like in building a tower, like in an engineering project, with all the more reason we have to embrace the cross of Christ voluntarily and generously. Because there's no other way in which we can follow Christ. Those children did not embrace him voluntarily. But they are connected to us somehow. Sometimes that sacrifice regards how we build our tower, the house of our sanctification. You know that famous passage from C.S. Lewis, I believe it's in Mere Christianity. He says, imagine yourself as a living house. God comes in to rebuild that house. At first, perhaps, you can understand what he is doing. He's getting the drains right and stopping the leaks in the roof and so on. You knew that those jobs needed doing, and so you're not surprised. But presently he starts knocking the house about in a way that hurts abominably and does not seem to make any sense. What on earth is he up to? The explanation is that he is building quite a different house from the one you thought of, throwing out a new wing here, putting an extra floor there, running up towers, making courtyards. You thought you were being made into a decent little cottage, but he is building a palace. He intends to come and live in it himself. Am I building a tower, a palace for you, Lord, for you to live? Are you building a tower that the Lord speaks about? How many floors are in this tower? How many floors are left? And we talked about the watching the construction site. This will be a huge building one day. There's a huge, massive, gaping hole. But the massive office tower or the apartment building will have glass and reflections and lights. But a large part of that work, as you watch the workers with special fences cordoned off, all with their hard hats, do not enter signs. A large part of the work required to build that tower is mere drudgery. A former resident in Ernstcliffe talks about working in construction, and what does he do? He installs windows all day long, one window after another. You can imagine one of those huge office towers, they have a lot of windows. But now he says he's learned to do it very fast. He steps it in, he pushes it in, he puts the caulking, he does, you know, every window is like a light from God into the office worker. And he feels proud of the fact that he's giving light to those office workers. And he knows how to do many and fast. We must be ready for drudgery at times. That is, humanly speaking, it's not always exciting work. But it can sanctify us and it can sanctify others by the light it gives. And for that, we have to have a higher vision as we're doing it, as we're up on the 15th floor, installing things, as we're writing a note, as we're sitting in front of our computer doing that work, as we're interacting with people. Maybe you tell us their problems or their hardships, and we nod and acknowledge and show empathy for their problems. In his memoirs, Bruce Springsteen recounts how mesmerized he was by seeing Elvis on the Ed Sullivan Show. Ed Sullivan Show was a famous show that every American would watch in the 1950s and 60s. And it was astounding for him to watch this. It's what he wanted to be. But then, even more fascinating, 1964, the Beatles appeared on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he felt the same, like, the same call he felt when he saw Elvis. That's what I want to be. This same devouring curiosity. And so he went to the local five and dime store. He made his way to the record section, way in the back. And he found there what he describes as the greatest album of all time. It was Meet the Beatles. Meet the Beatles. And it showed the Fab Four all with their faces on the cover, half shadowed. And I had that album too, actually. I had that album too, so I was really struck when I read about this. You know? And I remember the four faces of, you know, Ringo, John, George, And he said, that's exactly what I want to do. And so he learned how to practice. He imitated some of their great solo pieces. He spent hours playing in his room. He said, Oswald Chambers once noted, drudgery is the touchstone of character. If we are able to endure drudgery, it shows we have character. And David Brooks goes on to describe the long years of work and discipline of drudgery, but of never being discovered. He himself was not a guy who partied. He, despite the blue-collar factory themes that Bruce Springsteen evokes, he never actually worked in a factory himself. He kept a strict schedule. After each concert, he'd go back to his hotel room, have some food, take up a book, and go early to bed. Even though he was like the greatest, you know, he didn't party like that. He was finally discovered in 1972 with his album Born to Run. He was on the cover of both Time Magazine and Newsweek. In the very same week. Well, that's back when it meant something. And a lot of that was, you could say, okay, he had success, but he had to maintain a disciplined schedule so as not to be taken away by this. Kevin Major says that our father said a sign of sanctifying work is to finish it with enthusiasm, the same enthusiasm you started it with. Enthusiasm. What does it mean? It means entheos. Entheos. In God. Divinized. And when you're enthusiastic, you're like, yeah. It's as though something divine has connected with you. We can ask in our work, how do I really get entheosed? How do I really get divinized? Maybe I need to have more rectitude of intention. Maybe I need a grander vision as I do that drudgery of work, as I type away that code, or just prepare my classes. Maybe I just need a touch of enthusiasm, inner and outer, just for the day ahead. Lord, give me that enthusiasm. Understanding that it's not an emotional high, it is a high in a certain way, in the sense that we're brought up high to God when we work. When you walk on the streets now, you often see people running to work with their Starbucks coffee in their hand. Sometimes people will have a whole tray full of them, gingerly carrying them and having their laptop underneath, and they're on their way to work. They've got four coffees there. They've got a couple of donuts underneath their arm. And sometimes just the whole tray is teetering there. And think of that enthusiasm with which they're going from Starbucks to work. Think about the enthusiasm that Starbucks has in making coffee for them. You know, the fact that you can get enthused about making coffee, the people who have to make that coffee, who have to grind the coffee and then put some cool taste into it and then mix it in with cream, and people get enthused about that. Starbucks gets enthused. Timmy's gets enthused. Second cup. Recent poster read from Starbucks: New Year, cool new brew. Introducing the oh-so-smooth pistachio cream cold brew with silky pistachio cream, cold foam, and a brown buttery topping. Whoa. This is like, yes. I'll go for one of those. Then you go and says, $8, please. Oh, my God. Just for a cup of coffee, you know. A Another poster said, long walks with cozy pistachio. Give a warm welcome back to pistachio. Latte, creamy, and comforting for wherever winter takes you. Yeah. I don't know who these people are who write up these texts. You know. This is that is drudgery too, writing up those texts. You know. The collect of our Father's Mass. Ut quotidianum laborum in spiritu Christi fideliter exercentes. So that we do our daily work faithfully with the Spirit of Christ. Eodum filiu tuo configuremur, configured with your own Son, redemption sopir ardente amore serviamus. That we serve the work of redemption with an ardent love. Redemptionis opere ardenti amore serviamus. With ardent love, we serve the work of redemption. That's, am I serving the work of redemption when I do my work? When I, so to speak, prepare the lattes that I have to prepare for others? To be like our work, to be like our Lord, by converting our work into prayer, into an encounter and dialogue with God, by means of offering our work to Him, by means of aspirations while I work, acts of love. This next golden hour, I will offer it up, Lord, for vocations. This next golden hour, I will offer it up for the wisdom that the Father needs for the decisions He has to make. This next hour, I will offer up for my friend who is afraid that he might have cancer. This next hour, I will offer up for the people that come to the meditation tonight. So many things we can offer the next hour for, or the next half hour. Am I doing that work of redemption? Those aspirations, exerting effort in His presence, using those human devices, just like a cross there. That's it. Just a cross. It says Roma. Roma. I think of the Father. I think of the Holy Father. I think of the Roman Curia. Roma. The enthusiasm that our Father had for being there so close to the Holy Father. There were some recent short videos there of our Father speaking on the work. One lady asks, you know, how to overcome routine and boredom. All days seem the same, burdensome. Sin brillo, she says. Not very glamorous. And our Father says, no, que no, que no. He's, the way he's, you know, I'm sure you're capable of converting the prose of every day into heroic verse and poetry. Then he gets excited, like he just like, you know, it's not true. No, es verdad. No, it's not true that all the days are the same. If you put love in each day is different. Well, that's what we ask Sidus Rhea, saint of ordinary work, to intercede for us. So we can say that, no, we get enthused, entheos, in offering our work divinized to God. I thank you, my God, for the good resolutions, affections, and inspirations you've communicated to me in this meditation. I ask your help to put them into effect. My Immaculate Mother, Saint Joseph, my Father and Lord, my guardian angel, intercede for me.